From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. On today's show, the movie studios are touting their Golden Globe nominations, but what are we really to make of them? Then the curators of an exhibit about the year 1919 make 100 years ago seem not so far away.
Rather than kind of hammering away on the 1919-2019 parallels, what we hoped is that people moving through would make those connections themselves.
And we introduce you to a rarity, an all-LGBTQ mariachi group. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. But we're about to hear from John. He's covered the movie industry for more than two decades as a print reporter, and so we figured he's the best person to explain the significance, or lack thereof, of the Golden Globe Awards. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association today announced the nominees for its annual awards, which take place in early January. But rather than detail the usual inexplicable nominee choices and snubs, we thought we'd talk about the relationship between movie fans, the Globes, and the entertainment industry. First, John tells us who makes up the association.
What's important to me about the Golden Globes and about some other kind of minor film awards is that this is not a representative body. There are about 90 journalists, and if you go on the website for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, you can no longer even find their names or where they work. It's a very small group of people, and they have undue influence because the movie studios have figured out that if they woo the voters for the Golden Globes and their filmmakers win awards at the Golden Globes, it kind of creates some sort of momentum for the Academy Awards, but none of it is very legitimate. And the HFPA has cleaned itself up. It's not as scandal-ridden as it has been in years past, but this isn't an elite group of film writers or film critics that are making these selections. And if you look closely at the selections, not just this year, but in past years, the fact that they aren't really that serious as kind of film lovers starts to reveal itself pretty quickly.
How so?
Well, let's talk about a couple of past nominations. 2013, there were three nominations for a movie I bet you've never heard of, Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. That was a Golden Globe whopper. And if you go back 9 years to 2010, there was a movie with Johnny Depp called The Tourist that was largely derided that ended up getting multiple nominations at the Golden Globes. And I think if you look closely at some of the selections this year, it's clear it's driven by the red carpet. Like, who do they want to have on the red carpet? You look in the TV category, there are multiple nominations for The Morning Show, a Apple series that didn't get great reviews, because Jennifer Aniston is coming, Reese Witherspoon is coming as nominees. And then you look at Ava DuVernay's When They See Us, one of the most critically acclaimed TV series of the past year, didn't get any nominations.
So it's important for the NBC show to, you know, have that star clout. So there's eyeballs. So people watch.
I think that's part of the bias historically for the Golden Globes, that you can say, if they're judging between good filmmaker and A-list name, they generally are going to vote for the A-list name. And they also have some historical biases, you know, that are shared by the Academy. In the 77-year history of the Globes, only five women have ever been nominated for Best Director. And this year, there are lots of really good female filmmakers that were up. Greta Gerwig for Little Women, Olivia Wilde for Booksmart, Alma Harrell for Honey Boy, Marielle Heller for Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Not one of them got nominated. So the Golden Globes has a pretty poor history when it comes to nominating women.
The Golden Globes has made some effort to try to rehabilitate this reputation. What has it done?
It's made sure that people who are members actually have legitimate credits as journalists. There have been some reports of, I guess you could call it, bribery or expensive gifts in the past. I think they've tried to eliminate all of that. So again, they have cleaned up their act. But there's only so much legitimacy you can bring to yourself when you're only 90 journalists writing for publications that, if we had the names, I guarantee you, you've probably never heard of them.
And yet the industry, I guess, mostly plays along, and an actor or director or studio can use success at the Globes as part of their campaign going into Oscar season.
100%. And I think that is one of the most interesting parts of the story. Everybody in Hollywood knows in their soul that the Golden Globes are really not totally legitimate. And yet, the studios and independent companies and marketing departments embrace them because they recognize there's a game to be played. And the game is, we are going to court the Golden Globe voters. We're going to have screenings and Q&As for them. And if we get a nomination, our actor or our filmmaker is going to be on their award show, and people are going to start talking about the film, and one thing begets the other. But they do know that really it's not totally legit, but it serves their purposes. Academy Award campaigning is a multi-million dollar business. There are people who work as campaign consultants who get hundreds of thousands of dollars for getting nominations or Oscar wins. There's a huge business behind all of this. And in some ways, it might drive ticket sales or people to stream movies. So it's driven by finance. It's driven by trying to get eyeballs on the movies. But it's all kind of a hustle.
So, John, I've never covered the entertainment industry that closely. So, like a lot of people in the public, I really always just saw the Golden Globe Awards as the first among that more high-profile award shows to spotlight the top films of the year going into Oscar seasons. Am I off on that?
Well, you're not technically off. I mean, because the Hollywood Foreign Press Association nominates in two different categories for most of the major film awards, they cast a wider net. So just mathematically, they're bound to include a lot of movies that end up getting nominated. I wouldn't say they're that much of a bellwether, but because they're embracing so many movies, they have a mathematical chance of getting most of those things right.
John Horn out in New York. John, thanks for joining us to talk about the Golden Globes. We'll see you when you get back.
Thanks for sitting in.
And before airtime, we reached out to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to request a list of voting members and the news outlets they represent. They declined our request. Coming up on The Frame, a look back at a turbulent year. Not 2019, but 1919. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. If you've ever been to the Huntington in San Marino, not far from our studios in Pasadena, you know it's easy to spend an entire day just strolling through the neatly manicured botanical gardens. But next time you're there, don't skip the library and the art museum. In celebration of the Huntington's founding 100 years ago by Henry and Arabella Huntington, the exhibition 1919 paints a picture of that first tumultuous year. The exhibit is comprised entirely of items from the Huntington's collection that were either acquired, published, or displayed in 1919. From Benjamin Franklin's handwritten autobiography to suffragist pamphlets celebrating the passage of the 19th Amendment. John Horn recently paid a visit to talk with James Glisson and Jennifer Watts, co-curators of 1919. They explained what Henry Huntington was focused on collecting 100 years ago.
By the time 1919 rolls around, Huntington had purchased on the order of 120,000 items. So it's a huge collection. It was on the East Coast still. And he's still aggressively buying. So he puts in bids at something like 50 auctions that year. He, the week before the trust document is actually signed, one of his favorite dealers brings $121,000 worth of Shakespearean works to the house here in San Marino. So he is still all in, and actually it just ramps it up in the 20s. So he's still buying the great works of British and American history and literature, really focused on the great men of history.
So he is also trying to do something in San Marino and California that I think is important in terms of what we're seeing now. And that is to establish this area as a rival to the East Coast and maybe Europe. And does that start to affect the kinds of things he's buying?
Well, he's very much focused on early American history and literature and early British history and literature. So he's working really hard to collect all the first editions of Shakespeare. He's actually competing with the British Library. And he's also competing with some of the major East Coast institutions. But he's got the leg up because he's buying entire libraries at a time. So all the early papers of Virginia, you know, come here and whatnot. But it's really not until a few years later that he really starts thinking about California as an emphasis for collecting, and Californiana, as we call it. And his librarians really start going in whole hog on that. I mean, Huntington is creating history as he's settling here by bringing this institution here, but also by just the very fact that he's brought the streetcar system. He's real estate is his main occupation, and he's laying out suburbs. So he's sort of, history's in the making with Huntington here.
Like anybody who is collecting art at the time, Henry Huntington has a European white male focus. And that is reflected in a lot of what you see in the art gallery walls. When you're thinking about how you can represent a broader spectrum of the country at that time, at 1919, are there things in the collection that can illustrate beyond what Huntington himself might have been drawn to? Because his collection, his focus was pretty narrow, as were a lot of people at that time.
So keep in mind that while this exhibition is about the year 1919, it includes items brought to the Huntington all the way up to 2019. So some moments in the show where we tell other stories are the U.S. Marshals papers, for instance, that are right here. They're the kind of parole records, so to speak, for German citizens who were required to report to the marshal's office once a week and kind of check in. Other German citizens were jailed under pretty flimsy charges. We have an amazing book by Delilah Beasley. It's the history of African Americans in California, published in 1919. We have Wobbly, Industrial Workers of the World literature. We also have a lot of material, believe it or not, about the German Revolution. So one thing, it was a discovery of Jenny's, in fact. The Huntington has an extraordinary collection of German posters from roughly 1917 to about 1920, 1921. We've got 10,000 of them. We've got four on the wall. And one of them reads, warning, I'm translating, stopping is prohibited. Rioters will be shot. This is an image from the German Revolution of January 1919, which was a short-lived communist revolution. And I think that's definitely a story along with the Wobbly material and along with this U.S. Marshals material that one might not expect to encounter at the Huntington.
So much of what you're talking about suggests what's going to happen in the years and decades to follow. The registration of German Americans suggests the internment that's going to happen during World War II. There are artifacts about the Wobblies and about the fight to unionize and the penalties that some union organizers faced, which was death and lynching. And then there are things like the German Revolution. When you start thinking about what this snapshot of 1919 represents, how much of the future history of the country and the world do you think is really told if you start looking closely at what we're seeing here?
An extraordinary amount. So really, it's the mishandling or the stumbles at the Versailles Peace Conference that set the stage for the Second World War. It's the social chaos in Germany in 1919 and the near breakdown of civil order right as the Weimar Constitution's being written that sets the stage for the rise of the Nazis in the 1930s. Isolationism in American foreign policy for the 20s and 30s becomes set at this moment. But it's not, as I like to try to say, it's not all bad. So women get the right to vote. Huntington's streetcar system is kind of at its apogee in 1919. And that's the sort of backbone around which the metropolis of LA would continue to grow for another 40 or 50 years before they ripped it up and put in the freeway. And what we hoped in setting up the exhibition is that people moving through would make those connections themselves rather than kind of hammering away on the 1919, 2019 parallels. Let people make those connections themselves. And certainly you did it.
So I want to look at some maps. So can we go walk at some maps?
There are some amazing maps around us right now. Mm-hmm. What is this epic map that goes almost across the entire gallery? What is this?
So this is an epic map. This is a 39-foot-long linen map, rolled linen map, which is completely unrolled. It's the first time we've ever unrolled it, which is depicting the and delineating the Pasadena Short Line red car system from Old Town Pasadena all the way to the outskirts of downtown Los Angeles. Drawn over decades. The Short Line opened in 1902 and was going for many, many decades. So everything that's shown on this map reveals not only the route of the Pacific Electric red car, but all the contiguous real estate holdings, the titles to land, the deeds, the changes in place names, the additions of towns, but it really shows the extent to which transportation and real estate are intertwined in the city of Los Angeles. Really, Huntington put in his transportation network to get people to his real estate holdings. It was a loss leader for him. And so he was really trying to move people out to the hinterlands where he had built these suburbs. And remember, these suburbs also had racially restrictive covenants on them, as did many of these neighborhoods that the streetcar is going through. So it's just an amazing time to really reflect on the demographics and the topography of the city and how it got to be the way it is.
How does sound and music play into this show? I saw that you put together a Spotify playlist. What elements of music are represented either visually, or do you want people to walk around the gallery listening to their Spotify playlist about the Huntington show?
Well, right here on the wall, we have some sheet music covers, and I think just reading the titles give you a sense. So there's Salvation Lassie of Mine. She's in an army uniform, and you can see in the distance a bunch of soldiers heading into what looks like a canteen. There's another called I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, and it's this woman looking in the distance surrounded by a whole bunch of bubbles. Let the Rest of the World Go By, My Baby's Arms.
I call my sweetheart a baby. She calls me baby too.
You'd Be Surprised by Irving Berlin. And then my favorite, How You Gonna Keep 'Em Down on the Farm After They've Seen Paris.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they see away from Broadway, jabbing around and painting the town.
And what all of these started to say to us is that this was a really a moment of nostalgia. So for all of the world-changing events, for the horrors of the war, for the tragedies of the Red Summer and the violence against African Americans that year, you know, popular culture, pop culture, that's what this is, isn't reflecting that. Instead, it's giving us a nostalgic light view. And we felt like this, the room we're standing in is called Return. And the Return section is not just about soldiers coming home, but about this desire to kind of turn the clock back, which we all know isn't possible.
James and Jenny, thanks so much for having us in.
Yes, thanks a lot, John.
Thanks.
That was John Horn with Jennifer Watts and James Glisson, co-curators of 1919 at the Huntington Museum. The exhibit is open through January 20th. Coming up on the frame, an LA ensemble that bills itself as the world's first LGBTQ mariachi group. Welcome back to the frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. The word for rainbow in Spanish is arco iris. Rainbows are rarely associated with the super macho world of mariachi music, but one group is changing that here in Southern California. They are the Mariachi Arco Iris of Los Angeles, or LA's Rainbow Mariachi. The name is a nod to the gay pride flag, and that's appropriate, given that the band calls itself the world's first LGBTQ mariachi group. The Frame contributor, Marcos Najera, has the story.
You know it's Christmas when you hear Mi Burrito Sabanero.
Con mi burrito sabanero voy camino de Belén.
The classic Latin American carol tells the story of a child's journey of faith. There are countless versions, like the 70s original, camino, to this more modern take by Guatemala's Gabby Moreno, even neo soul man Alo Black. Con mi burrito sabanero, voy camino de Belén. But nobody does it quite like Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles.
El lucerito mañanero ilumina mi sendero. El lucerito mañanero ilumina mi sendero. Si me ven, si me ven, voy camino de Belén.
That's because this is arguably the world's first out and proud mariachi troupe.
Because we're arcoiris, we're special.
And its star is Natalia Mari Melendez.
She's feeling diva-ish.
She's equal parts musician and history maker. The troupe promotes the violinist as the first transgender woman in mariachi.
I didn't know I would be like a spokesperson for our community. I try to set the standard really, really high.
But out in Pico Rivera recently, this rising star faced much more mundane problems.
I'm a girl, I like my nails.
During a late night run through of Burrito Sabanero, her manicure melted down.
These ones here, see what I do is I get my nails done, but my left hand, because it's my fingering hand, they're all cut short, but my thumb. On my right hand, I have all looking long and pretty. But they're falling apart. Don't clown me.
I wasn't clowning. I was like,
out, honey. Read, girl, read.
You can tell Melendez and her fellow musicians have formed a little family over the years.
We communicate through an app. It's our own personal mariachi app. Girl, that library stays open 24/7.
There's lots of laughter and lighthearted teasing at rehearsals and shows. It's a rare sense of camaraderie and good cheer the troupe tries to offer fans.
That is exactly what we give the LGBTQ plus community. LGBTQ plus ABCDEFG. They just keep adding and adding and adding, girl. It's the whole alphabet. Okay, on a serious note, we want to engage you. Because when you go hear mariachi, regular mariachi, like, you hear the man sing, and then he's singing all that pain to his woman or whatever. But what if there is a gay man that is feeling that pain? You want to feel that, too. You really do. Me, as a trans woman, I always wanted a man to sing to me.
Acaba de una vez.
And I wanted him to mean it.
De un solo golpe.
And that's what arcoiris does, you know. Men sing to men, the lesbian will sing to another woman. That's our niche.
Melendez fell in love with the violin at 8 years old while growing up in LA's El Sereno neighborhood.
Those were some good years for me, honey.
But family strife and deep depression crept in by the time the young gay boy became a teen. And soon, he left L.A. for a year to live in a Christian retreat.
I just prayed about it because I was like, I was at my wit's end because I was trying to numb who I really was. Ask God, I'm here, I surrender. If I'm to be a man and be with a woman, put it in my heart and let me know. Or the woman that I feel I am, and obviously that's what he gave me. So I left over there and I came back to Los Angeles, trailblazing.
Pero ya no hay remedio.
Looking back, Melendez wishes she had a trans woman role model to look up to. Ironically, had the internet been more reliable back in the late 90s, Melendez might have learned about another trailblazer, Teresita La Campesina. La Campesina was a trans woman who performed mariachi and ranchera music in San Francisco's Mission District back in those days. UC Santa Cruz professor Marcia Ochoa remembers her well.
Everything stopped when she started singing, you know. It was just all about channeling that voice.
Ochoa says while Natalia and Teresita may have never met, she believes Teresita watches over Natalia as a trans ancestor.
As we say now, you and I, a transcestor.
A little bit more...
Back in L.A.,
crying.
Arco Iris' director, Carlos Samaniego, leads rehearsal with a bit of an iron fist.
Get the right phrasing.
But these rigorous rehearsals have paid off. They are in constant demand.
I remember when we did our first same-sex wedding. I got the phone call, and it was one of the grooms, and he said, is this right? I can't believe it. He's like, I can't believe you guys exist. I'm like, Mariachi Arco Iris saving the day with mariachi at your gay wedding. And I think it's fabulous.
I'm Marcos Najera for The Frame.
And that'll do it for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. The Frame is back here on Thursday from the Moen Broadcast Center. Happy Hanukkah and a Merry Christmas to all. Silence.